Now, as you realize, the theme that has been stressed and underlined over these last few weeks is this: our utmost for His highest. And with that theme in mind, and repeating it again and again, as I hope we have opportunity to do, I want to turn to the book of Nehemiah, and to Nehemiah himself as an outstanding character. You might therefore wish to have your Bibles open to Nehemiah chapter 1, though we will be looking at one or two other verses within the book itself. So I want to introduce you this morning, or remind you, of a man who undoubtedly and without question gave his utmost for his highest, or for the one who is high above all. And I trust that we will find in him a model to emulate, to follow. He was a man with a mission. He pursued the unthinkable. And there are some things in life which appear to be completely beyond our ability to attain. But even what is unthinkable, we might consider as being in our sights and striving for. He pursued the unthinkable, and he proved to be unthinkable. He had his trials, he had his troubles. Difficulties mounted one on top of another and might have overwhelmed him. But this man was unsinkable. He persevered and he was unstoppable. There are many things that might have stopped him. Certainly he met with opposition. There were numerous opponents. But he is outstanding because he endured. Things unthinkable, he proved to be unthinkable. And he persevered, and he was unstoppable. Nothing was going to beat him as he set his mind and applied himself to the work that God had entrusted to him and had put within his heart. This is Nehemiah. We read of him in verse 1. Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now, of course, having said all that, it is possible that with arms folded, you could indifferently simply sit back and say, well, who cares? Big deal. And you could indeed turn your back upon such a man like this and walk away. But I ask you to be patient and to give consideration to Nehemiah. Because this man was one of Israel's greatest leaders. One of Israel's greatest fighters. And one of Israel's greatest intercessors. And if we would serve the living God in this 21st century, then we should follow such a man who lived in different times, but proved the faithfulness of God. Who was forthright. Who was indeed honorable. He was a man who inspired others to great deeds. And there's one thing I'm going to talk about this morning, and it is this. He inspired them with the passion of words. Notice here, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And he used words, employed words. Words were something that he recognized as being necessary to ignite a flame within the heart of others. And well-chosen words, words that were opportune and meaningful at that particular time, he used in order that he might instill a fervor and a flaming passion in the heart of others, that they would be gripped by the same vision that he himself had. In chapter 2, in verse 17 and 18, he says to those that are with him one evening, possibly a moonlight night, He says, you see the trouble we are in. That may not be a very good beginning. Why do you draw our attention to this, Nehemiah? We live here. You have come from afar. You've got a cushy little job being cupbearer to the king, and you don't know anything of what we daily have to face and live with and live through. We know that we're in trouble, and there's plenty of it. You see the trouble we are in. Big trouble. How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. All of this is seen and noted and registered by those who shrug their shoulders in one sense and say, listen, Nehemiah, we've been here for months, we've been here for years, and nothing has changed. This is what we have to face on a daily basis. We know all about that. But he hasn't finished. He sets out what indeed appears to be a hopeless state of affairs. And then he says, come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. That's the challenge. That's the invitation. You see the trouble we're in? Well, we could just simply sit down, as it were. We could be overwhelmed with self-pity. We could be commiserating with one another. We could say things are never so bad as they are today. If only we could somehow recapture the glory of what has been lost and simply just sit there and moan and complain and grumble and have no hope for the future whatsoever. But he said, come. Things are bad. But come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem. And as they listened to him, you will notice what they said in verse 18. As they listened to him, he said, let us rise up and build. Let us rise up and build. Yes, we've been overwhelmed with depression. We've been disconsolate. We have faced the derision of our enemies all around us. We have yielded to despair and to despondency. We have been overcome with this dark cloud that has cast its shadows above us and around us. But as they listened to Nehemiah, the man with words, plain, simple, straightforward words, something was ignited within their heart again, and their eyes were open. They got a glimpse of a vision of something that had been lost, but which Nehemiah had. They said, yes, come and let us build. Let us not despair. Let us build again with what remains. Let us build upon these ruins. Let us build and rejoice, and let these stones be the foundation of a new day. Nehemiah had gone off, or had got time off to leave Susa, or Shushan as we have it in some versions. He had got time off to leave the city. It was a one-time great city of the Persian Empire. And he went away with the blessing of the Persian king to see for himself the devastated and the depressed condition and circumstances of Jerusalem. And when he got there, he sneaked out one night and did some reconnaissance and research. Everybody for years had passed by the ruins. And they despaired. They had lost heart. But where they saw hopelessness, Nehemiah saw hope. Where they saw oppression, Nehemiah saw opportunity. I wonder what you see when you look at things. Through what kind of eyes? When it relates maybe to the church, to the conditions and to the circumstances in which the people of God find themselves, as even we do. Ourselves at this time. The United States men's hockey coach, Herb Brooks, provided some motivational words to his team before they shocked the world and pulled off one of the greatest upsets of all time by defeating the Soviet Union hockey team at the 1980 Olympics. And the coach addresses his men. And he said to them, in 1980. Great moments are born from great opportunity. And that's what you have here tonight, boys. Great moments are born from great opportunity. Imagine Nehemiah saying that to the men who accompanied him that evening when the moon shone upon those ruins and they went doing some reconnaissance. And he turning to them and saying, great moments are born from great opportunity. And men, that's what you have here tonight. Let us rise up and let us build. And they heard the call. And they rose up. And they began to build, as you know the story, with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. And they built. And they fought. In chapter 4 of verse 14, Nehemiah again addresses the people and says, do not be afraid of them. That is the enemy, the opponents, those who are throwing obstacles in our way. He says, do not be afraid of them. Fear paralyzes. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. That is a stirring invitation to everybody. Notice the positive words. Do not be afraid of them. Don't allow the enemy so to intimidate you with their words and their threats that you will fail, as it were, to rise up and you become paralyzed. Don't fear men or their faces. These are words that set before us what are the priorities of life. And you will notice that Nehemiah goes on to say, remember the Lord who is great and awesome. That's the priority. Don't let them put fear into your hearts and remember the Lord. So often we're man-centered. All we see are men, their words, their threats, their intimidations, what they will do to us if we don't do this or don't do that. Do not fear them, but fear God. Remember the Lord who is awesome and who is mighty. That's the priority. And in this secular materialistic age, even we as Christians can lose sight of God. All we see are governments, authorities, powers that be, men, shouting, screaming, raging. Don't fear them. Remember the Lord. And they're passionate words because, you see, he calls upon them to fight. It's a call to war. And we need to have the spirit of a warrior within us that we ourselves will fight in this day and age for that which we deem to be precious. And they're patriotic words. They're the words that will be addressed to a nation. Fight for your brothers. Fight for your sons and your daughters, your wives, your homesteads, for everything that is dear to you. Rise up and fight. All these things are precious. Fight for your liberty. Fight for your freedom. You know, words of one or two syllables stir the hearts of a people to fight for what is dear to them. And Nehemiah is inspiring these people to build and fight. And so he appeals to the heart to look to their help, who is the Lord, and to remember their homes. To him who is the Lord, remember the Lord, and remember your homes, your hearth, your homesteads, your wives, your sons, your daughters. Remember this. Is it worth fighting for and dying for? Remember. He just uses simple, plain words. Martin Luther King inspired a nation with words that were not in his script. He was up until about 3 o'clock in the morning writing what he was going to say before leading the march in Washington many years ago. He scribbled and scribbled away and crossed out and he scribbled and scribbled away and he crossed out. And even before he was about to speak, he was on the platform still writing and still scribbling and erasing and changing things along the way. And then he got up. He spoke those words that were not even in the script. I have a dream. And if we remember nothing else in the speech, we remember those words. I have a dream. Winston Churchill, with simple Anglo-Saxon words, inspired a nation during World War II. He said, "We shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old." The people of England during World War II turned on their radios and they listened to the speech that was made before Parliament. And it put something into the hearts of the British people, and they fought and they went on to fight the enemy. "We shall fight." And Nehemiah calls with simple words the people whom he is addressing to fight. This generation has produced many who are articulate in many walks of life. It is a generation that uses words to persuade and paint a vision of what might be. I recommend that you look and listen to those who give TED Talks, T-E-D. Listen to them. Many of them are young. They are enthusiastic and able public speakers who talk on a range of subjects in the sciences and the arts and social realms. You don't have to be a professional orator to move others with words. You need a passion in the heart that will put fire into your words. You need fire in the bones and fire in the blood, and there will be fire and passion in your words. And there will be a natural, overflowing oratory, not studied, but you're so moved by your subject. History tells us that 12,000 people once heard John Wesley preach. These 12,000 people came by foot, by ox cart, horseback, and carriage. And they came all day long to hear the little man who could spark enthusiasm in everyone who heard him. And one man made his way through the crowd and asked John Wesley what was the secret of attracting so many. And Wesley answered, "I don't know. I just set John Wesley on fire, and people come to see him burn." And when you have somebody who is a leader and who is passionate, even with words, there's a sense in which he is on fire. And when there's a fire, you are attracted to it. You see the glow of it. You feel the warmth of it. You're struck in your own heart by the passion, and you want something of it. Nehemiah burnt with passion in more ways than one. Not only with the passion that inspires, but the passion of indignation. We're almost left with the impression sometimes that if you're a Christian, you're very calm, very nice, very pleasant. You don't say anything or do anything that is disturbing. That's the kind of person that you happen to be because you're a Christian. Really? "I was very angry," said Nehemiah, chapter 5 and verse 6. "I was very angry. I was very angry or grieved." Chapter 13, verse 8. And I threw all the household furniture of Tobiah out of the chamber. He was one who was opposing the work. And you see, not only was he angry with words, but he got pretty muscular. And he got hold of the furniture and he chucked it out. And I kind of am reminded that somebody else did that, or something similar to it once in the temple, turning over the tables of the money chambers and chasing out those who were dealing in commerce. And it was none other than the Lord Jesus. You know, people have got this notion that if you are a meek little Christian, you're a weak Christian. And you just simply lie down like a doormat and let everybody, as it were, wipe their shoes upon you. Oh, that's okay. That's all right. I'm a Christian. I'm very nice and very pleasant, etc. Oh, dear me. No. We need the passion of indignation. A righteous kind of anger. Bring back Martin Luther with all his coarseness. Bring back John Knox, who was not afraid to stand before the Queen and speak in the way that he did about the monstrous regiment of women. Bring back these men who had backbone and who were strong and sturdy. And you men, you yourselves should be men who are prepared to stand up and to fight and not let your women do the fighting for you. You should be leaders and prove that leadership within the home and that leadership wherever God has placed you and a leadership also within the church. Nehemiah's words were words of power and persuasion and passion and practicality. Here then was a leader who made use of words to do at least three things. One, to inspire people. In chapter 4 and verse 6, we read, the people had a mind to work. It seems as if they didn't really have that kind of mind before Nehemiah came on the scene. But after he came on the scene and said, come, let us build. Let us not sit back, as it were. Let us not be commiserating and, as it were, wringing our hands with a kind of self-pity, such, oh, dear, these things are so bad. It's never going to be the same again. We can't do anything about it. No, he said, these people now had a mind and a heart to work. Do you? Or do you sometimes find that your passion for the things of God begins to flag? Because you've had so many knocks, setbacks. Are we going to go through this again? One storm after another. Things crumble all around us. Oh dear, let's give up, as it were. And in the heart, in your spirit, you despond and you despair. May God put within each of us a mind to work. You see, the words have practicality. They have practical implications. They're not just words. Oh, that was a nice lecture. That was a nice sermon, etc., etc. Yeah, that was good. I'd like to hear that again, maybe. They began to work, to involve themselves, roll up their sleeves, do something, take a shovel or pickaxe or whatever it might be. They began to work. So his words were used to inspire, to ignite a flame within the soul. And then to instruct, to teach. There were at least two ways in which Nehemiah gave himself to the task of teaching. One was through the scriptures. And there is a reference to two or three times, like in chapter 8, verse 9, and chapter 13, and verse 1, to the law of God, to the law of Moses. There was that appeal to what was authoritative. And so through the scriptures, he instructed the people. But not only through the scriptures, there was instruction also through song. Chapter 12, verse 31, talks about two choirs that he formed. There was one on the right hand, as it were, one on the left hand. And they sang They rebuilt the walls. And one of the climatic moments was to sing. And in that way, they were able to sing about all that God had done and all that God is, and to render praise unto Him through the voice in that particular way. They sang. The third way in which his words were used was to indict, that is to bring a charge, and issued a reprimand. You find that in chapter 13, verse 11 and verse 17, where Nehemiah himself speaks to some of the leaders and some of the elders, if you like, there within the church, chapter 13 and verse 11. He says, I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. He got the leaders, and they were to be leaders not just in name. They're given a sort of a tag to wear, as it were, and he's this, he's that, and so on and so forth. Are you doing your job? Are you fulfilling your role? You're in a position. Okay. Well, now take care of the church of God. Verse 17, I contend with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? So they were going off the path, and he corrects them, he rebukes them. I'm not above rebuke or reprimand. Neither you, fellow officers, or any other leaders in the church. And we need, as leaders, to be called to account for what we are doing and why we hold the office that we do. The words of Nehemiah was the glowing lava which came out of the heart of a man on fire with passion to give his utmost for his highest. And what motivated his life and moved his lips was passion for the city of God. In verse 2 of chapter 1, Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked him concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. Verse 6, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now day and night for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you, both my father's house and I have sinned. And in chapter 2, verses 3 through to 5, Nehemiah relates to the king of Persia what was upon his heart and made him appear sad in his presence. Because it wasn't really a good thing for you to appear sad in the presence of the king. And so the king inquired, why are you down? Why are you looking the way that you're looking? What's your problem? May the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lie waste and the gates are burned with fire? You know, Nehemiah could have remained a mourner, but he chose to be a mover. To move for God, to move with God, and to move others. He could have remained broken, but he chose to be a builder. He could have remained amongst the riches of Susa, but he chose to serve amongst the ruins of Jerusalem. And he went more than an extra mile in the interest of the city of God. Nehemiah had a vision. Leaders have vision. Leaders inspire and ignite in the hearts of others a vision. Do you have a vision for the church? The church in general, or this church in particular, whose walls have been broken down, here at least, in recent months? Do you have a dream? And we could look at the gaps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. There was a time when there were a lot more people here. In recent months, for one reason or another, they have gone. And we still, in a way, sort of feel the tremors of what has been. And we look at this. It's like walls broken down and the place once again in ruins. And how do you feel? Well, all right, it's understandable if you feel bad about it. But you're going to always feel bad about it. You're always going to feel down about it. Is our God still the same yesterday, today, and forever? Is he still almighty? Can we still trust him? Come on, let us rise up and rebuild. I have a dream. Do you have a dream? Do you have a sense of vocation that is calling as a member of this congregation? Not as a member, but as a member of this congregation. Some of you are Presbyterians, some of you are Baptists, some of you are not sure what you are. But I'm asking you as the members of the congregation, do you have a calling to help rebuild the walls? With the grace that God gives to you and the gifts that he bestows upon you and the use of your time and the use of your energy. Only one life soon will be passed. Only what's done for Jesus will last. We can become so engrossed with the world around us and the pursuit of the things that are tangible and temporary and not really give ourselves to the cause of Jesus Christ and do our utmost for his highest. You may think it's my job. Hey, what do we pay you for? You know, you're full-time this, and you can do it. But don't you know I'm busy here, I'm busy there, I've got my career, my calling, etc., etc.? Yes, I know that. So what? You are first of all a follower and a disciple of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's your first calling. Your first commitment is to him, to Jesus Christ. And if in following him and serving him, there are many things that you may have to forego, then that's a result of following Jesus. Don't complain about it. You got a problem? Talk to him about it or just give up. Don't play at religion. Don't play at Christianity. Do you long to see a vibrant company of people with all their diversity serve in unity to the glory of God and the furtherance of his kingdom? And will you aid this particular cause with words proclaiming the truth to one another, with words of love as you care for one another, words of edification by building up one another in our most holy faith? I conclude this morning there are meanings in names which are expressed in words. And in the opening verses of chapter 1 and verse 1 and verse 2, there are three names which tell us in words things that we should not forget. These are the words of Nehemiah. What does the name Nehemiah mean? It means the comfort of God. The comfort of God. And as we rebuild, as we set our sights upon what lies ahead, so God, the God of all comfort, is that awesome God, is that mighty God to sustain us and to nourish us. He is the son of Hakaliah, and that means to wait upon the Lord. If we would engage in this work of rebuilding, then we need to wait upon the Lord. You will notice one of the things about Nehemiah, he was a busy man. He had great responsibilities. But when he came back, he never ceased to be waiting upon God. And you and I are to wait upon God, to cry out to him. And his brother's name, you notice in verse 2, was Hanani. And that means God is gracious. God is gracious. And our God, who is the God of all comfort, God who is enthroned on high, upon whom I am to wait, is the God who is very gracious and who will sustain, support, enable, that we might rise from our speeches, that we might reach for our tools and have at our side the sword, that with the trowel in one hand and the sword in the other, we will build and we will battle and we will fight in the interests of the city of God, the New Jerusalem. Amen.